You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear two interviews. The first, an interview with Lauren Stein, editor of the Paris Review. And the second, a discussion with Vanessa Blakesley, author of the novel Juventud. First, we'll have a conversation with Lauren Stein, who is editor of the Paris Review. His criticism has appeared in Harper's, the London Review of Books, and the New York Review of Books. His translations include works by Grégoire Bouillet, Michel Houellebecq, Edouard Leroy. For more than half a century, the Paris Review has launched some of the most exciting new literary voices, from Philip Roth to David Foster Wallace. But rather than trading on nostalgia, the storied journal, reconceived in 2010 by my guest, Lauren Stein, continues to search outside the mainstream for the most exciting emerging writers. Harmonizing a timeless literary feel with impeccable modern taste, its pages are vivid proof that the best of today's writing more than upholds the lofty standards that built the magazine's reputation. The Unprofessionals collects pieces from the new iteration of the Paris Review by contemporary writers who treat their art not as a profession but as a calling. Some, like Zadie Smith, Ben Lerner, and John Jeremiah Sullivan, are already major literary presences, while others like Emma Klein, Benjamin Nugent, and Otessa Moshfegh will soon be household names. A masterclass in contemporary writing across genres, this collection introduces the must-know voices in the modern literary scene. When I spoke with Lauren Stein last week, I began by reading a blurb about the collection. Hilary Mantel writes, "Good writers are always beginners, unprofessionals, driven by desire, ears open, vision wiped clean. They find their home in the Paris Review." I then asked Lauren Stein to start by talking about the title, The Unprofessionals.
Well, that's a very good question, and we've heard a fair number of people wondering why it's called The Unprofessionals. This is a collection from, we relaunched the Paris Review, my colleagues and I, 5 years ago,
Okay. And
wanted to bring it back to its original mission as a magazine, as a discoverer of new voices, especially in fiction and poetry and literary essays, and of course as a canon maker in our interviews with famous writers. These mm-hmm. are the things that we started out doing, and it's what we went back to do again because so many of the literary magazines that we cared about had folded, and so many of the new magazines weren't really focused on writing for writing's sake.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought there was an opening there. And in fact, in the last 5 years, since we relaunched the magazine, our circulation has almost doubled in print, and we have more readers now than the magazine has ever had in its 62-year history.
Wow.
So there was a need out there, I think, for this kind of magazine. And we called the book The Unprofessionals because one fact about this last 5 years is that there's been an explosion of emerging talent, new writers, especially in their 30s, 20s, early 40s, but really especially writers in their 30s who grew up before the internet and social media but have become writers in the internet age. And that generation has never been represented, I think, in one book. We've seen so many of these great new writers winning lots of prizes and in some cases becoming quite famous in these last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been coming through the Paris Review for lack of because I think it's the most popular literary magazine in the country and one of the best known.
Yeah.
So we get to see a lot of this stuff. These writers are unprofessionals, not because they're not good at what they do, God knows, but because at a moment when we're all called on to do so much reading and writing of personal/professional marketing copy, really, these writers have really taken a stand for another kind of writing, which is writing for the page and intimate writing and not marketing writing.
Yeah, yeah. Something that you just said reminded me, I'm looking for it and I'm not finding it, but in Sarah Manguso's story, Short Days, she has a line about writers of a certain age and how they already know how to be famous because they're so used to taking their own pictures and being famous online. And it sounds like that's the generation that precedes the one you're talking about, or that came after the one you're talking about.
Isn't that a wonderful, I have it right here.
Great, yeah.
Here it is. Sarah Manguso writes, this is, I'm reading from the book, "The difference between today's under 30 writers and its over 40 writers is that the former, like everyone their age, already knows how to act like famous people, people whose job it is to be photographed." What Sarah Manguso doesn't go on to say, but I think is implied, is that the job of being photographed is not very good for the job of writing, that those two things don't sit easily together.
That's true, yeah. Now, that story is an interesting story. It's a list of the author's wisdom sort of presented as aphorisms on writing and love and life. What was your reaction to that story when you first read it?
I wasn't sure whether to call it a story or an essay or what to call it. I think in the end we called it an essay. Sarah Manguso showed me a much longer set of aphorisms, and together we culled them and to find ones that sort of told a story. We played with the arrangement, and maybe told a story is too strong, but that have a certain kind of build to them. Part of what these aphorisms are about is, for example, the thread of Sarah keeps bumping into young men who are training as soldiers or mm-hmm. who have come back from tours of duty mm-hmm. and their relationship to literature versus academics whom she meets and whom she works with and their relationship to literature and writers and theirs. And a lot of those aphorisms have to do with problems of writing, but others have to do with problems of sex and marriage and mm-hmm. raising kids. Mm-hmm. And I think for Sarah and a lot of the people in this book, those problems are all part of the same set of anxieties, mm-hmm. challenges.
Yeah. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about your editing style. How do you approach your work? And is there any way that you would describe your editing style?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that I'm the one to...
That's
to
true.
Answer it, because I've
you're
never
not taking editing. Your own picture all the time.
I'm not taking my own picture. No one wants to see my own picture. But we get lots and lots of submissions, mm-hmm. and every day I read a bunch, and I spent most of my grown-up life as a book editor, and I do a little of that now on the side. But one difference between being a book editor and being the editor of the review is that, by and large, when we select something to publish in the review, it tends to be a very finished thing already. There are exceptions to this, but in general, these things are so short that you fall in love with them as is. Mm-hmm. There isn't a lot of monkeying around that you do with them.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you mentioned your work as a book editor too, and you've had a very you're part of a very literary family. It sounds like your sister is an agent, your wife is Sadie Stein, the writer and editor, and you yourself went to the Johns Hopkins writing seminars. Did you used to think that you'd be a writer and then decide to be an editor, or were you always going to take this path?
Well, I went to the poetry program at Johns Hopkins and taught there. I went partly to see if I could become a teacher. I thought I might do that. But what I really wanted to do was be a novelist.
Okay.
And when I left, I tried to do that for months and months. I did nothing but live cheaply and try to write the first page of a novel. And I never got past the first paragraph. then I went and worked for Publishers Weekly, a trade magazine, and I think working there, I really fell in love. It sounds kind of funny, but seeing what was published every week, what was coming out every week, I really fell under the spell of this one publishing house, and I dreamed. It was the first time that I had a realistic career,
yeah.
Work desire, and that was to be an editor at that publishing house. And I ended up Farrar, Straus & Giroux. I ended up working there for 14 years, and I'm back there again. And so, looking back, when I was a kid, I edited the literary magazine. I did some of that in college too, and I always enjoyed editing more than I liked writing. It's much easier.
So if you couldn't be a novelist, do you wake up every day and say, I am the editor of the Paris Review? Like, do you have to pinch yourself?
Yeah, I do. I'm pretty bruised. I pinch myself. It is a dream job.
Yeah.
It's pretty wonderful to have been trusted with this magazine. That means so much to me and to my friends. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk a little more about the collection, The Unprofessionals. I wanted to ask you about ordering a collection, putting it into order. You know, I know that at least one previous Paris Review collection was alphabetical. That's not the case with this one. This one is more varied. You have a story and then a poem and then an essay and then a poem and et cetera. So I wondered how you made these decisions. And also, I noticed that the table of contents is not done that way. You do categorize them by form. So what was that decision like also?
Well, from the beginning, we knew that we wanted to do an anthology of younger writers from the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was important to us to do prose fiction, prose nonfiction, and poetry, because those are the three kinds of creative writing that we publish.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to lay it out the way we lay out actually every issue of the magazine, where if you look at the table of contents, you can see what's fiction, what's nonfiction, what's a poem, what mm-hmm. we're calling a poem, even if it, let's say it's a prose poem. But if you're just reading it straight through, there are no big flags saying, read this as a story, read this as an essay. I do think that essays and short stories are different. I have a pretty old-fashioned sense of what makes something fiction or nonfiction. I think if it's made up, it's fiction. If it's mm-hmm. not, it's nonfiction. And there are borderline cases, but most of the time you know what's what. At the same time, we really want people to read a short story the same way they read an essay, and even the same way they read a poem, not to come to one as if it's dessert and one as if it's salad, but to treat all of these things as maybe arguments of a certain kind, or at least as forms that make a serious a demand on your attention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, when you read The New Yorker, a magazine that I love, and read religiously, there's something about the way the poems are happening in the middle of a Seymour Hersh piece. Well, that's not always the best way to encounter a poem. I love the stuff that they publish, and they do a great job, but just the very format of the magazine, it encourages different kinds of attention, and we try to break those barriers down as much as we can. We have that luxury.
Okay, great. The first piece in the collection is a short story by Otessa Mashfek. So the story is called A Dark and Winding Road, and I was wondering if I could just read a little bit of the beginning and then ask you about it?
Please do.
Okay, great. My parents kept a small cabin in the mountains. It was a simple thing, just four walls and very dark inside. A heavy felt curtain blotted out whatever light made it through the canopy of huge pines and down into the cabin's only window. There was a queen-size bed in there, an armchair, and a wood-burning stove. And it goes on. And my question is, I loved this story, and I loved the beginning of this story, let's see, there was a queen-sized bed in there, an armchair. And then later, the word there is repeated many, many times. It's definitely intentional. And I just was so interested in that, and I wondered what your reaction was to that in the piece.
It's funny. Moshfeq, for my money, there's no one in her generation writing better short stories. Specifically, okay. She's also a novelist, but to me, her short stories, there's something really special about them. And one of the things that I love about her stories is that they're imperfections. And sometimes, I mean, you're very attentive. It's exactly the kind of thing that I will sometimes query as an editor. And she is such a deliberate writer. It's always fun. I'm always feeling as though I'm getting schooled as I read her stuff and ask her about it. She always knows exactly what she's doing. And those little, that narrator is such a vivid character, a guy who goes off to this cabin to be by himself because he and his wife are about to have a kid. And as he puts it, my life would be ruined forever. And he's going to give himself this time alone. But the more time he spends by himself, the more we find out about him, mm-hmm. more than he knows about himself. We start to see the way drugs and alcohol operate in his life and the way sex is in his life, and things get quite weird.
Yeah.
And I think, like a lot of her stories, this one deals very intimately and non-judgmentally with the experience of shame. And mm-hmm. I think that's something that fiction can always do better than nonfiction, or almost always, is talk about those intimate moments that are hardest to speak about in your own person.
Yeah. And the title is so perfect, A Dark and Winding Road. I mean, it sounds from the beginning like the title refers to this cabin or the road through the mountains, but it's really a very dark place that he's going in his mind as well. And I thought that the word there was just sort of pressing in on the darkness. I don't know why. It just worked really well.
I think
well.
You're completely right. Yeah. We read it the same way, you and I.
Yeah. There's another story in the collection, Leela by Angela Flurney. It begins with a main character being evicted from her apartment. It's literally the moment of her eviction when she is stuffing things into plastic bags and trying to decide which possessions she can keep. She's going to have to live out of her car. And then the next part of the story is all about her gambling addiction, and I was not expecting it to go there. And I loved the way this author established sympathy for Leela in the beginning in that eviction scene, and then took her to the casino, and we already are sympathetic to her. And I think that if those two moments had been reversed, we would have had a very different reaction to her. And I liked that. It was a nice surprise to me. I wondered if you wanted to just say anything about that one.
Oh, well, I never had thought of it, but you're absolutely right. The sequence makes it impossible not to sympathize with her.
Yeah.
But if we'd seen her behaving irresponsibly, and this is someone who's struggled, who's gone to addiction meetings and stuff, something we hear nothing about, and she's really screwed up at work, she's lost a job because of this gambling problem, and if we knew that before we saw her dealing with the the bailiffs, is that the word I want? The men who've come to
right.
To kick her out. If we'd known that about her first, it's true, we probably would have had a harder time sympathizing with her. But as it is, we like her a lot.
Right. We have that very specific detail of what it's like for her to pack up. And these men aren't even allowed to touch her things, and so she has to do everything by herself. It's very well done.
Yeah.
How hard was it to choose the pieces for this collection? And did you have any heartbreaks that you had to exclude a certain piece that you really wished you could include?
Oh, there were a few of them. I'm thinking of one very funny story that I love, but that seemed a little bit too light for this collection.
Mm.
There was a long story that is pretty well known by Joshua Cohen that was in the review, that it was just too long, and I knew that the publisher would have a hard time with the printing costs if we kept it in.
Mm.
There were a bunch of hard calls. I tend to love pretty much everything we publish in the magazine, and even narrowing it down to younger writers, it made our job a little easier in one way because it was a principle of selection. But some of the things that I love best in the magazine are not by young writers, but by older writers. And so I wish we could just turn around and then do another anthology of older people. Actually, maybe we should.
Yeah, you could call it The Professionals. Okay, great. So there's I don't want to omit poetry from our conversation. There's there's a lot of wonderful poetry in this collection. There's one I just loved called The Difference by Aishan Hutchinson. This poem describes a conversation between or among men. I'm not quite sure how many men. It sounded maybe like two, but I may have just been imagining it. And he doesn't get specific about their conversation, but the wordplay is wonderful, and the way that he conveys their conversation without ever offering actual dialogue. One line or a few lines, they talk Egypt failing, Greek broken, and it takes cash for France, not charity, and I rather speak Russia than Ukraine. Just really fun wordplay that totally conveyed this very manly conversation.
That's right.
And I wondered, first, if we could talk about that poem a tiny bit, and also your approach to editing poetry versus prose. Do you find that it's very different for you?
Well, I should say that we have a poetry editor who's been in this with me from pretty much the beginning,
mm-hmm.
Robin Presswell, who's an Arabist by day. He's a professor of Arabic literature, and writes about Arabic literature for The New Yorker and other places, and is very interested in the way poetry actually is working today in the Islamic world, and even the poets who are coming out of ISIS. He wrote co-wrote a long article about the poetry coming out of ISIS right now. It's an interesting moment, and I mention all that because I think Aishan's poem is partly about globalization and the way language, the way English is being used by these non-native speakers to describe a world that none of us is native to anymore.
Mm-hmm.
This globalized world, where these roughnecks are they're oil guys, and they travel where the money is, where the oil is. In general, we have a kind of peculiar attitude toward the poetry in the magazine, Robin and I do. We read a lot of journals that publish difficult and esoteric poems, and a fair number of the poems that we publish, I would say including that one, are difficult. They don't explain themselves right away.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we thought that our particular mission as a poetry magazine was to publish poems that would interest the general reader of American literature now. So these are not written for professionals. These are not, so much poetry now is really by professionals for professionals. And we like things that, put it this way, it's no bar to entry if the poem is something that you could tear out of the magazine and stick on the door of your fridge. That's actually something we like, you know.
Yeah, okay, great. The Paris Review has always embraced experimentation, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit about experimentation for as almost like as advice for writers who like to experiment, who might be listening.
Well, the word experimental is sort of odd because, I mean, we all use it, but a lot of things that are difficult or funny in some way we call experimental, meaning that they belong really to an old tradition that goes back to Gertrude Stein, say. But then there's another kind of experiment, and that's trying to figure out how to capture something about the life that you're living right now that's different from the life that you might have lived 5 years ago, or that your parents might have lived, or that we would live in a different place. And that's the experiment that really interests me, is it comes of having read a lot, knowing how people have written about things in the past, and seeing what in your experience has not been described, and finding a way to do that. That's a lot of what we're looking for, I think, in what we publish.
Okay, wonderful. That's great. Lauren Stein, thank you so much for speaking with me. I want to just mention that the collection is called The Unprofessionals, New American Writing from the Paris Review, and it's published by Penguin. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Lauren Stein. You can learn more about his work and the Paris Review at theparisreview.org. My second interview this week is with Vanessa Blakeslee, whose novel Juventud came out this fall from Curbside Splendor. Her debut short story collection, Train Shots, published by Burrow Press, was the winner of the 2014 Independent Publishers Gold Medal in Short Fiction and longlisted for the 2014 Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award. Vanessa's writing has appeared in the Southern Review, Green Mountains Review, the Paris Review Daily, The Globe and Mail, Kenyon Review Online, and Bustle, among many others. Winner of the inaugural Bosque Fiction Prize, she has also been awarded grants and residencies from YADO, the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, the Banff Center, Ledig House, and the Ragdale Foundation. And in 2013, she received the Individual Artist Fellowship in Literature from the Florida Division of Cultural Affairs. Born and raised in northeastern Pennsylvania, she's a longtime resident of Maitland, Florida. Vanessa Blakeslee's Juventud explores the idealism of youth, the complexities of a ravaged country, and the stories we tell ourselves in order to survive. Growing up as the only daughter of a wealthy landowner in Santiago de Cali, Colombia, teenaged Mercedes Martinez knows a world of maids, armed guards, and private drivers. When she falls in love with Manuel, a fiery young activist with a passion for his faith and his country, she begins to understand the suffering of the desplazados who share her land. A startling discovery about her father forces Mercedes to doubt everything she thought she knew about her life, and she and Manuel make plans to run away together. But before they can, tragedy strikes in a single violent night. Mercedes flees Colombia for the United States and a life she never could have imagined. 15 years later, she returns to Colombia seeking the truth, but discovers that only more questions wait. When I spoke to Vanessa, I began by asking her about her interest in Colombia, the setting for much of the novel Juventud.
Well, this came about in a really unexpected way, as much of fiction does. I've never been to Colombia. I have no family there. I'm not Colombian American.
Wow.
I have working class roots from northeastern Pennsylvania. But this came about because of a conversation that I had in college around, let's see, it was 1999. I was with a group of young women, none of them really close friends. They were acquaintances, and the one student was from Colombia, and we were all talking about our first loves, first experiences as teenagers. And so when she chimed in, she said, "Well, my first boyfriend was killed one night. I was young. She was 14, and he was a little bit older, in his early 20s, and she said, my father didn't like me dating him. My father was determined that I get out of Colombia, because this would have been the 90s, get out and finish my education in the U.S., mm-hmm. and I didn't want to go. Mm-hmm. I was in love with this older guy. And she said, one night we were out at a nightclub, and this hitman came up and shot him dead and he died in her arms on the nightclub floor. Mm. And, of course, we're sitting around just speechless listening to this.
Right.
And then she said it got even more harrowing because she said, I'll never know for sure, but I suspect that my father might have had something to do with it. And then, of course, she told more, and she had mentioned where this happened in Colombia and more details. I forget what the father did for a living. I forgot most of it, but just that, those core details just really haunted me, and they stuck with me for a few years. So I was about 20 when I heard this, and it didn't come out in fiction until I was in my first semester at the Vermont College MFA program, and I tried writing it as a short story. And it just had too much of a backdrop, too much of a scope to fit into the short form, which shouldn't be too surprising.
Right.
I mean, that's quite a lot. Those are some pretty big dramatic questions
right.
to try to fit into
yes,
a short story.
Absolutely.
Maybe Alice Munro could pull it off.
She could, but her stories tend to be 50 pages, and it's okay.
Yeah, yeah, and it's okay. But so that's where it came from.
Yeah.
But then also, this is a rather long answer to this question, but in that time, a different turn of events took me to Costa Rica when I was in Vermont,
okay.
at Vermont College. And so I spent almost a year in Central America, and so I really was immersed in the cultures, you know, the people, the food. Colombians are one of the largest expat groups in Costa Rica because
okay.
of the conflicts of the 80s and 90s. Many of them lived there,
yeah.
Moved there, and our landlady at the time was Colombian. So I began to interact with expat Colombians who'd been...
Fill you in
on their stories. So I heard even more, and just the sensory details of the region, the mountains, the agriculture, all of it became very familiar to me, so that when I returned the material, I felt I could authentically borrow some of the Costa Rica details
yeah.
and plug them into.
Right. And were you already fluent in Spanish?
I'm not fluent in Spanish. I'd studied it intensely in high school and college. And then when I was in Costa Rica, my Spanish, of course, was pretty decent.
Yeah,
I could have
sure.
conversations. And now, unfortunately, it's been, I didn't speak it after, and that was a few years ago now. So sadly, I cannot,
that's
you know, if
really
you speak to me in Spanish right now, I'll be, you know, completely, you know, perdón. Which, but, I, you know, to go from being able to speak conversationally to, but, you know, if you don't use it,
yeah.
you do lose it. And
well,
and,
I was a Spanish major in college.
Oh, were you? Okay.
Yeah, and I went
My sister
to
was
Madrid
well.
For a year, and that's mm-hmm. a long time ago. And it goes back to a place in your brain that you don't need to access very often, but it does come back.
Yeah, it does come back, but it was complicated by I studied French in between,
and then
that
it's
can
like tennis
really
and racquetball. Then, you can't do both.
and oh my goodness! So then, when I did sometimes go to open my mouth and speak, you know, the wrong language will come
yeah.
out. It's just yeah. These
yep.
are the perils.
It's funny because it makes it easier to read either or both, to know them both, but to speak
to
it
speak
is...
It. Not,
yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk about writing a storyline that takes place in a country that's foreign to many of your readers. I'm wondering if you could just read this little paragraph. I found it lovely. It's got setting, but it's also culture-specific mm. action, which I think helps to fill out the scene mm. for readers.
Certainly. Right after Anna introduced us, she slipped off to flirt and left Manuel and me alone. The mountains made dark silhouettes by the city lights and the moon. Some friends casually kicked a football among them. Their cigarette smoke cut through the heady sweetness of the tree blossoms, and their banter boomed and fell.
Thank you very much. That's just a little snippet of some of the most lovely prose. So I just wondered if you could talk about setting. And now I want to change the question to talk about writing setting that you're not personally familiar with, too. So that's really interesting. So,
yeah, well, and, you know, that paragraph, it just, what strikes me about it as a writer is just how often I went through that scene, and I don't think I came to that image of including the friends on the sideline kicking the football until almost, you know, very late in the drafting process.
Okay.
Again, pushing myself to think about those details that are unusual but true to the people
yeah.
in the book, and not wanting it to be, you know, you're always trying to push yourself away from stereotypes.
Yeah.
So I really like the combination of the smoking cigarettes and play, you know,
right.
they're not carrying out a football game. This is it's happening at a party.
Sure.
So what would kids be doing
kicking
at a party?
Yeah.
You know, Latin American teens. And the backdrop of the mountains, again, having Google Earth is very friendly to the fiction writer these days. It's really true. And I've seen, there's a few movies that are set in Santiago de Cali. Perro Come Perro, I don't know if you're familiar with that. That has some lovely shots of the city. It's a pretty gritty movie about thievery, and it was indie film. But you know, you can get a snapshot of the city there. And so I borrowed a lot of what I had seen in San Jose, Costa Rica. It's a similar city, you know, tucked into a valley with these great mountains on either side. Yeah. So
you could take lots of notes.
Yeah, and in my mind's eye, I could see it.
It's interesting. It's so funny, the difference between writing from memory and writing with immediate access to detail, isn't it?
It is very different.
You know, like if you had gone to Costa Rica before you were already aware of this book that you wanted to write, it would be so hard to access all of that, probably.
It would be very different, You know, if I had not had that premise planted in my mind and my imagination, simmering back there, because I think I find it so fascinating how I believe the subconscious works on our fictional ideas far more than we're even aware.
Right.
You know, they kind of cook back there for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, it would be very different if I had gone to Costa Rica first and then
tried to remember, just look at all your old pictures and go, why didn't I take a picture of this?
Yeah, it would have been.
I wondered how much, and again, this is much more interesting now that I know you don't speak fluent Spanish, but how much did you feel a need to offer Spanish words and translate them? And how difficult was that to do smoothly for an English audience, English-speaking audience?
Yeah, that's an excellent, excellent question, because it's something I really grappled with. Because, of course, especially in part one of the book, this is all taking place in Colombia.
Right.
So everyone is speaking Spanish, but this is a book that's being written for an American audience, primarily.
Right.
So, you know, I really resisted the effect of sprinkling in, having a lot of Spanish in there, or, you know, when you come across a Hollywood movie and it's everyone's speaking in really thick accents of that country, but you know, you think, well, why didn't they just film it in that language and then have subtitles, and it would have been more authentic.
Right.
You know, I really didn't want that, but at the same time, I felt to have no Spanish in there would be almost glaringly awkward or obvious in a different way.
Sure.
So I went with, you know, here and there in the dialogue, there are certain words that we kept in there, and the foods, of course, yuca, and you know, there's a number of different dishes, lechona, a roasted pork dish. We, of course, kept those, but I really ended up keeping it, paring down the Spanish, because I trust the reader enough to let them imagine that these people are speaking in Spanish. And
it's funny what you say about film, because in film there are things you can do. You know, I remember with the film The Hunt for Red October with Sean Connery, and at the very beginning his character is speaking in Russian, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly.
And
they used subtitles, and then they zoomed in on his mouth and he started speaking English, and they zoomed back out and you were to understand that everything from now on is Russian. But, like, it was awesome. I thought that was so creative, but you cannot do that in a book.
That is a terrific tactic because, I mean, there you go. And with actors, sure, you can have... How much Russian are you going to expect someone like Sean Connery to learn?
Right.
You know, he can memorize a paragraph, but...
And it's still going to have the accent.
And it's still going to have the... But, and similarly, I mean, how much foreign language do you want to bombard your reader with? I mean, I'm just thinking of War and Peace when you come across, and frankly, I did try to read War and Peace a couple of summers ago. There's so much French in it, and I have some background in French, but you know, you really have to read constantly flipping to the back. There's just these long, you know, segments where these are upper class Russians from the 19th century. I love the believability. I mean, they would be speaking French. That was very true. But
even the names in a Russian novel, because they use both the first and the last name with every,
you know, tag. And,
right.
And they all are so foreign to the names that we're used to, so it's hard to get used to that.
Yeah, so you're keeping track of that. And then, you know, Tolstoy's
throwing worth it if you stick it out.
Yeah. So it is worth it, yeah. And I just wasn't up to it at the time or wasn't in the right frame of mind or whatnot. But yeah, being aware of, okay, you know, who is my audience and what, how much do I want to push this and in what direction do I want to, how much is enough for just believability?
Yeah.
And so, and then we also made the decision at the end of the book. I had played around with italicizing the Spanish or not, and then we made the decision at the very end to take everything out of italics that was in Spanish and just make it straightforward,
right.
Just regular typeset. And I'm glad we did that because, first of all, it certainly makes it easier for continuity and decide, you know,
right.
Which words are going to be.
And typeface can bump your reader out.
Yeah. So I'm glad we did that.
I wanted to just ask you another question that sort of ties into my earlier question about setting, but I loved the way you used vibrant detail to establish the situation and foretell the romance between Manuel and Mercedes, and also to establish setting again. So I wonder if you could just read this tiny little bit as well, starting right there.
Manuel and I would roam the historic district, buying a flavored ice or another street snack to eat on the steps of the Museo de Arte Colonial. Manuel's shirts were always dusty with sawdust and wood shavings, and he smelled like freshly cut lumber and the faint grease of tools. I wore my horrendous school uniform with a baggy vest and the skirt that hung to the knees.
That's great. Can you talk about writing romance without tipping into cliche or stereotype? And, I mean, just literary romance. I mean, romance is a part of life, and unfortunately we've genrefied it to the extent that people don't want to, like, even
touch it.
Yeah. Like, romance.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. And sex scenes. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my
God. How do you do that? Mm-hmm.
So, and I thought, and I'm sort of answering my own question, but I thought you could maybe speak more broadly about this. The way you use the vibrant detail, mm-hmm. just really helps. So anyway,
Well, thank you. That was another, certainly a challenge in writing this. The first danger is, you know, even though I'm a literary writer, when you write those scenes, you do tend to have a few too many, you know, it's hard to avoid the thudding heartbeats and
right.
the passionate, using the word passion. I mean, I did have to go through and go, you know, strip that out of there.
Yeah.
And I think the answer for me was really, again, driving it toward the concrete and sensory and just other things happening in the room. You know, I think at certain points I had, you know, how the fan felt against her skin,
right.
and things like that that took it away from the, I don't know, thrusting of bodies.
Yeah,
and the thing is, you actually can get away with a little bit of that.
Well,
rolling in the shade.
That comes from a place of real description.
Really,
it's just been overused.
Right? Yeah, it's just been overused. So if you can, you know, really ground in other places, you can kind of get away with a little bit of what you have to get away with, which is, you know, some sweat and and all of that. And also thinking about, I was very conscious of just how women tend to be portrayed in, you know, the stereotypes of lovers and women in, mm-hmm. in Hollywood and in fiction. And I really wanted to push in a different direction. And I thought, you know, there are often not scenes of women getting pleasured. And so there was much later in the book, in end of part one, the end of Mercedes is having a birthday party, and she and Manuel kind of meander away from the party because people are getting drunk and raucous, you know, and they go up to her bedroom, and, you know, by this time there have been a couple of sex scenes also for variety. And I thought, you know, I really want to have him, you know, her, there's very few oral sex scenes in literature,
right.
So that was a big risk, and
yeah.
it sort of cuts away at the end, but things are definitely going in that direction, and again, I kept it very concrete as far as,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I think it was really tastefully handled, but I just wanted to show something that was I guess, you know, a woman's empowerment about her sexuality, and a healthy relationship between two young people, because
right.
I think it's not explored enough.
Right, and I do think that the stereotype of sex scenes and romance novels doesn't do that so much.
You know?
Like, women are not empowered at all.
No.
Absolutely.
So I really wanted to take the opportunity to, you know, it certainly was a challenge as a writer to see, like, oh, wow, how can I really pull this off in a tasteful way? And yeah, it was really, really fun.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about your research. The book, in addition to, you know, the setting and the language and certain things like that that you would have to research, there's politics and history, the drugs, the hijackings, the rebel groups, ELN and FARC, and the church's role in all of this. So there's a lot that you had to, that you really had to know about to write about this intelligently.
Quite a bit.
So was this just, you read books?
I did a number of different things, and I will say I don't think I knew what I was getting myself into at the beginning of this, with just this, you know, very bare bones premise that, and I, like many other Americans, only knew, gee, what did I know about Colombia as a 20-year-old in 1999, hearing this, my peer's story about growing up there, you know, knew about the drug cartels, knew there was something going on with guerrillas, but not very much else. And, well, one of the first things I had to do was narrow down the timeline of just when I wanted this to take place. So mm-hmm. I did some more broad reading, just on Wikipedia, you know, starting there with just general knowledge, getting more familiar with some key events. And there were some very helpful timelines on different sites about guerrilla violence that helped me narrow down to that period in 1999, where there was a real spike in, you know, the government talks and really not getting anywhere, really butting heads with the guerrillas, both guerrilla groups, but then especially the ELN did some very hairy deeds. They kidnapped an entire church congregation. They hijacked an airliner, a domestic airliner. And when I came across those events all happening in this, you know, 4 or 5 month period, I thought, oh my gosh, well, this is the perfect backdrop that I could, you know, my characters could be involved in this somehow. So then I moved from just visiting these websites to looking at more primary source material, online videos. I mean, people think of YouTube as offering a lot of cat videos, but beyond cat videos,
you can find on YouTube, absolutely anything.
So there were all of these, you know, people's home movies just from their handheld cameras or phones of peace marches and demonstrations in Colombia in the 90s, where I would put on these, you know, homemade amateur captured footage of these demonstrations, rallies, and I took notes from those of, you know, what did people look like? What were they wearing? What types of people were in the crowd? What are they doing? What are they shouting? What do the signs say? So
right. In
those crowd scenes, the rallies, and there's a few scenes in the book of rallies and demonstrations, the signs are actual signs that I saw in some of the footage. I just grabbed them.
Sure.
Because it's authenticity. And So I had that, and then of course I also used the internet for other details. I researched the agriculture, figuring out what kind of operation the father would have been running.
Right.
I settled on sugarcane, which is one of the crops of the region, and I also thought that made really nice imagery. Diego Martinez, Mercedes, the narrator, refers to her father as Poppy throughout the book, and he also has alpacas, so I did more than I needed to do with
alpacas.
And it's funny because that's one of those things that research sometimes can directly inform the narrative, but then, and I don't think I did a lot of extraneous research, I really thought those alpaca shearing sections needed to be in there. there was dramatic, you know, at one point there was information being revealed during the album.
Right.
But, you know, things are condensed, things are cut, and it's like, oh, now the alpacas are really just here and there, and I, you know, didn't need to know what I spent time watching.
But can say what you did and didn't
say. At the time, I, and it certainly helped immerse me in that world. So, but then I also read books. I read, you do have to be careful because, you know, if you just do a very perfunctory search, I guess, on Amazon, the first books that will come about Columbia are more pop culture. They're more kind of glitz and, you know, even the nonfiction. And I think I ended up reaching out to a few Latin American scholars, and they pointed me, they gave me a reading list of, and those were the texts that really were heavy. They were some pretty dense academic texts, and they're listed in the back of the book. And again, not a lot of that ended up directly impacting the narrative, but it really gave me a thorough understanding of the issues from, you know, understanding how the guerrillas, how the conflict in Colombia began its roots in the 50s and 60s, and then how that parlayed, I guess, into the drug cartel violence and, you know, the evolution of all of that, which I think was, it really made a difference.
La María Juventud is the name of a group that she becomes involved with. Is that a real group, or is it based on a real group?
It's invented. So the church kidnapping of La María, that congregation, was real.
Right.
So that becomes an event in the book. But I invented that because I needed I was also faced with finding an occupation or something. You know, who was this boyfriend, this lover going to be? And what could he possibly be involved in? I mean, as a writer, I'm thinking I want him to be sympathetic and alluring to readers. But the father, I want the father to not like him. So what could he be involved with? And also something that's going to lend into the themes of the book.
Right, yeah.
And so when I saw that event, I thought, oh, what if he is this youth, this activist, this very idealistic young man who's working very hard and really believes in saving his country. And of course the father's not going to like that. It makes him, at that time, anyone who spoke out was a target for guerrillas, paramilitaries, you know, and they were taken out often. And so no father would want his daughter involved with
someone like that. The other aspect of the plot that I thought was really interesting was Manuel and his group and his brother sort of push her into finding out more about her own family background.
Right.
And, of course, her father might have problems with that because he had a checkered background.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the way that you created Manuel and Diego both in ways that we could appreciate their positions and we could understand their characters, and we could find empathy for both of them, even though they were on completely opposite sides of this
situation.
Yeah. And I thought that was beautiful. You didn't make them black and white. You know? So that was great too.
Well, it took much drafting. We'll just say, because in the beginning, Manuel was he was a bit of the sappy lover. He was a little. He needed to be a little more. Have some more cojones. And so it took a lot of smoothing out, many, many tweaks, little tiny changes to make them the people they are.
Mm-hmm. Now there's a scene, I'm sticking so close to the beginning of the book, I wanted to get to some other parts too, but there is this great scene early on in the book where Mercedes invites Manuel to dinner to meet her father, and it's the first time that they will have met, although she hasn't been with him for very long. I was surprised at that.
Been hanging out about 2 weeks, but she's young, so she would need, I think, if she was going to progress in this, she needed to have some kind of parental involvement.
So she invites him over to meet her father, and the line that I loved was, "The evening began politely enough." I loved so much about the sentence. First of all, the foreshadowing. We know that it's going to not go so well eventually. Mm-hmm. But also the word politely, mm-hmm. you know, which is the best that we could do. You know, it began politely enough. It's never fully comfortable. So mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the use of foreshadowing to create suspense. Even in a small moment like this, I thought that was a beautiful example of foreshadowing to create suspense.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, in a book like this, which, you know, I guess could perhaps be deemed a suspense novel in some ways, it's really, really crucial because you want to, it's like a little thread throughout the book that you just want to plant enough, but you certainly don't want to be foreshadowing too heavily. So it's a very tight line that you've got to walk. And I, you know, another place where I think that really affects the narrative is with the mother's storyline, which mm-hmm. is a whole nother, we haven't talked about that
right,
at all, but
right.
Mercedes has an estranged relationship with her American mother who left when she was very, you know, a baby. And so that's something that is planted in the beginning, and then actually in the final edits, we ended up adding a couple of sentences through to just touch on that and keep foreshadow and keep that. And it's amazing how little you need to
yeah.
plant. Sometimes it's like literally little breadcrumbs, two, maybe three sentences we added in that part one of the book then to
right.
just tug on that thread and that foreshadowing. Her questions about, you know, why did my father, that would be huge. Why
right.
did my father keep me from my mother and grandparents? Did they try to contact me?
Right.
Or is, you know, is something going on there?
Yes.
And that makes, then when she does in part two, and I won't spoil it, but
right,
there
no
is,
spoilers.
Yeah, she does go to the United States and some resolution happens there. And it made it that much more powerful.
Yeah.
So
because all along, as you're reading the first part, you are aware that, of this mother, and mm-hmm. she's Jewish, which is
mm-hmm.
also really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, those questions
yeah.
were existed. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's you've got to have just enough. But again, it's often you're revisiting this stuff until the very
yeah,
end of drafting.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to just ask you about the title. Juventud means
mm-hmm.
youth.
Mm-hmm.
And so La Maria Juventud means, you know, the youth group of this church.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the title for, you know, beyond whatever ties it has to that group. Mercedes' youth is so key to this novel and her growth and her maturation. Was it your idea to use the title or did somebody
you know,
else come up with it?
I was really in a bind over the title because this was one of those cases. Titles tend to come fully formed or if they don't, it
right.
can be a real struggle. And this was the latter, which I was not happy about. But it had a title I just never really liked as a working title. And one of the editors at the publishing
a
house...
A title that somebody else had come up with?
No, it was a title that I was just
what was
using.
It
was called Branch of Heaven,
oh,
which
no.
I never... Yeah,
oh,
no. awful, awful. Terrible, awful title. And I tried when I met with, I made lists of titles, and everything felt forced and awkward and right. It just never came together. And then one of the editors said he had been thinking of a poem. I forget if it was a Neruda poem or, you know, some poem from a literature class he had taken. He said, and he, I guess, was familiar enough with Spanish, and he said, what about calling it Juventud, the
mm-hmm.
Spanish word for youth? And it was a risk because, of course, it's a Spanish word.
But it's one word. It's not
it's
a sentence.
But it's one word. Yeah.
And it's a good word.
And it's a strong word.
Yes.
And I know I've already had, you know, some people come up and say Juventud. So I'm going to get some Juventuds. But I think, you know, again, for this audience, I think many people are familiar enough with Spanish that I think they know. And it's also the same in Portuguese, and I'm not sure about Italian or other, you know, the other Romance languages, but
right.
Juventud means youth. But as soon as he said that, I loved it. I said, yes, I think so, because the book is very much about how in youth we tend to see things very much black and white. You know, the very fact that we're in our youth limits us from having a greater perspective,
right.
the greater perspective which we'll have looking, you know, looking back when we're older. And this very much directly affects Mercedes' story. And, you know, she's still it could be said she's still in her youth when she's writing it and telling it. At the end of the book, you realize she's in her early 30s. So she's coming really to the end, I guess, of her.
But she's been through so much.
But she's been through so much. So
yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, that sort of, it depends on how you're looking at the word youth or age, right?
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. All right, so I wanted to ask, because the show is for writers as mm-hmm. well as readers, so I wondered if you have advice. Well, let me just say, the book does go on to have multiple settings. It starts out, and it's very largely based in Colombia, but mm-hmm. then there are settings in the United States mm-hmm. and in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know if that was difficult for you to try and establish new settings that would, you know, sort of like bring the reader along and also any advice for books that have multiple settings.
It was. I would just say, you know, when you do your research, of course, you want to be thorough, but you want to do it with due diligence and compassion, I think, for the people you're writing about.
Mm-hmm.
And respect, of course, I think I would include with compassion. It was tricky to develop entire new stage settings, if
yeah.
you will, later on, and especially in the latter half of writing a book, a novel, you can be really exhausted.
Right, and that can be almost like starting all over
yeah.
with a new place.
Yeah,
the place
it is
huge.
But I felt very much that I wanted to connect the Colombian conflict.
Oh, and Costa Rica was
and Costa Rica,
right,
yes,
right.
Which wasn't difficult for me.
Yeah,
since
no.
I knew that was actually the easiest one
sure.
to write. I knew it so well, but. You know, I wanted to create these parallels and contrasts between Colombia and Costa Rica, mm-hmm. a neighboring country which is more peaceful, does not have a history of guerrilla, you know, and government conflict. And I really wanted to draw the parallel between the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and Colombia.
Right.
So I felt that chapter where she goes to Israel is very much very important, and drawing Mercedes, really fleshing her out as the millennial she is, and as the global citizen that she really becomes, which is true for a lot of people. I have a number
yeah.
of friends who are very educated, and they kind of live between countries, or they have one parent who's of one, you know,
mm-hmm.
belongs to one country, another parent who's different. You know, citizen of elsewhere, and they're these sort of global
mm-hmm.
citizens, and that's fascinating to me in terms of identity, where you feel at home, all of those sorts of things. And the chapter on Israel, that took a solid week of, again,
have you
Google
been there?
Earth. And that was tough because I've never been there.
Yeah, and that's so different.
But you really just have to read. You have to read about the weather, the climate. What does it actually, in a sensory way,
mm-hmm.
feel like
mm-hmm.
to be walking around there? And food is very important, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my advice to writers. Food, very
much.
bring all of this. You can really, really immerse yourself and get a grasp of those sensory details and bring them in. I feel like almost the most foreign setting, even if you haven't been there, you can build it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's interesting because we say the sensory details, and what occurs to me is that writers are constantly being told not to forget any of the five senses.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to a new setting, that might be a really nice starting place, is to kind of like think about the different senses, the five senses, and how is this place different to each of those than the last place you were writing about.
Exactly, and
yeah.
to push yourself in directions that are... The road less taken, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, often taste and smell are left out when
mm-hmm.
and when you travel to a foreign country, often taste and smell are going to be the sensations that are going to most strike you.
Sure.
So
yeah.
if a character is out of their familiar element and on a trip somewhere, you especially want to pay attention to bringing those in to
yeah.
the different foods and smells on the street that they're, and you know, you can do it. You can build that world.
Okay, great. So I wanted to just mention the name of the book again is Juventud. It's published by Curbside Splendor. My guest has been Vanessa Blakeslee. And thank you so much for being on Write the Book today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Vanessa Blakeslee, whose website is vanessablakeslee.com. This week's Write the Book prompt comes from part of my conversation with Lauren Stein, in which we discuss the repeated word there in the story The Dark and Winding Road by Otessa Moshfegh. Often, writers are told to steer clear of repeating words in close succession in their prose. And yet, this story absolutely benefits from the author's intentional repetition. And to my mind, it's that intention that makes the difference. Words that are repeated by accident are unlikely to do much other than bump the reader out, because the reader might notice, oh, you know, just a minute ago, she said egg beater. But words that are chosen and then placed carefully in succession to highlight something that a writer wants to draw attention to, these can be very useful and very beautiful. Former Write the Book guest Priscilla Long writes in her book on craft, The Writer's Portable Mentor, good writers delight in repeating good words. And then she later adds, if you have trained yourself not to repeat, learning to do the opposite takes practice and it takes developing your ear. The word there in Otessa Moshfegh's story becomes a good word, the right word, by the author's intention. She uses it to highlight the importance of the setting, which does lie at the end of a dark and winding road, but I think it also highlights the otherness, the there, of that narrator's present state of mind. So, this week's Write the Book prompt is to use word repetition in a way that will accentuate something intentionally. Practice reading the result out loud to be sure that the music is just right. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. We've run long on our time, and so there is no time for the Bookworm's calendar this week, I'm afraid. But do check out the calendar on 7 days if you're looking for great local arts events. That's an excellent resource. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook. And by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. If you are interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 until 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast by going to my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. or by visiting the website of my co-host, Gary Miller. His website is GaryLeeMiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. And this has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro. You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.